Good afternoon. I'll call to order me this State Government Budget Division meeting for Monday, March 17, 2008. We're going to be looking at getting feedback from the affected agencies on the governor's budget proposals. I'm going to go a little bit out of order. We'll start with the Department of Revenue. As my understanding, the commissioner has to be over the House in a little while to meet with one of their meetings, so we'll start with the Department of Revenue. So, Commissioner, welcome back before the Budget Division.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ward Ines, representing the Department of Revenue. And we have, I think, three proposals, governor's proposals, that fall within the purview of this committee. One is our overall operating budget reduction, which is $1.240 million per year. The other one is a stamping office that will generate about $3 million a year. And then thirdly, our proposal to do a bank data match, which is another what I would term a compliance initiative that we hope to generate about $10 million a year. I don't know, order do you want to take those?
Sure. Or? Could you describe each one, what it involves and entails? And I believe there's some people here who want to testify, I think, against the bank data initiative. And to the extent that we want to be fully informed, I think we'll take that testimony. But I want to give the Department of Revenue the opportunity to say how each one of these cuts is going to affect your operation, so we at least understand what it is. So.
Okay, Chairman. Yeah. Maybe I'll start with our generic, I call it generic, operating budget cut that the governor recommended. And as I said, it's $1,240,000 per year, and that's about a 3.1% reduction in the non-compliance side of the budget. And the governor, when he put out this recommendation, was very cognizant of not adversely impacting our compliance initiatives. As you know, Chairman, the legislature tasked us with a very ambitious compliance initiative last year. We're in the process of ramping up and trying to meet that goal. We're concerned about meeting that goal, but we're cautiously optimistic that we will. So that when the governor came forward with this recommendation, we basically are taking our direct compliance part of the budget off. So that will not be part of this reduction. So it's about a 3.1% reduction of the non-compliance side of the budget. And we think we can manage that within fairly reasonably by we've instituted a hiring restriction, travel restrictions. Also, we have an aging workforce, so through retirements and attrition, we think we can manage that $1.2 million reduction. Be happy to take any questions on that particular budget
item. So what does that actually mean in terms of your day-to-day operations? I mean, when you cut 3.1% of non-compliance, I mean, what do you do now that's not going to get done, or what positions don't get filled, or just how is that going to play out?
Right, Chairman. Chairman, over the last 8 years, as we've been tasked with multiple compliance initiatives, our overall budget has gone from about 50% compliance to 50% support to now we have a budget that's about two-thirds compliance, one-third support. So it becomes more and more challenging to stay clear of cutting compliance initiatives just because it's such a large part of our budget. But we think this 3% reduction is doable. It's about 20 FTEs potentially that would be impacted by this. And as I said before, we do have a fairly we have an aging workforce. We are expecting a fair number of retirements. We may keep some of those positions open. There's some attrition. We've also instituted a hiring restriction. It's not a freeze, but it's a restriction, very limited about what kind of positions we will fill. We've also instituted greater travel restrictions, out-of-state travel, and those kind of things will be curtailed. We're also revisiting our tuition reimbursement program. We have a fairly generous and robust tuition reimbursement program for employee development, a very important piece of retaining our quality workforce. But we're going to scale that back a little bit in order to facilitate this cut.
And, Commissioner, most of those positions right here in St. Paul or the other facilities, or have you identified anything that you're going to be looking at in particular?
Yeah, I couldn't get you a feel for about geographically where we're going to be at, but I will say this. For example, we added another 28 employees in Ely, so we have 100 employees in Ely right now, and they're all compliance-related. Okay. That those 27 new employees were all related to the initiative that you guys tasked us with. We also opened up an Egan office, I think 40 or 50 employees, and all those are initiative positions. So the people have come on board recently. In fact, every position we've hired recently that's a new position has been related to compliance. In fact, if you backed out our compliance positions, basically the department has been very flat as far as the number of FTEs. So we haven't identified exactly regionally where those cuts will be. But I would say the general rule, most of the support functions are in St. Paul and the metro area. Most of the folks we have out in our regional offices are in compliance mode. They're audit, field auditors. ELE is all collections. So I would expect the disproportionate amount of the cuts, if there are any, we're cautiously optimistic, Chairman, that we'll be able to make this reduction without laying anybody off. But those positions that aren't filled,
sure,
will probably disproportionately be in the St. Paul area.
I mean, will it mean slower customer service or longer lines or anything like that? Do you have any feel for how this might play out down the road? Obviously, if you cut out 20 FTEs, something's going to be felt somewhere.
Right. And I will say we are getting relatively lean on the support side already. We recently put another taxpayer advocate in place because we were doing more audits. When you do more audits, you get more taxpayer complaints and more taxpayer advocacy has to be done. Well, we're going to do everything we possibly can to not impact the taxpayer directly. We're still getting out our refunds within 2 to 3 days. We expect that to continue. We've done a pretty major migration to e-filing. E-filing even this year is up another 5% over last year. We're the lead in the country in e-filing. As long as we continue to promote kind of going to paperless filing and doing more e-filing, we can get by with fewer employees. So a lot of it's going to be about this integrated tax system coming in this committee helped fund. That should make it less, manpower, person power, driven agency. So there's things we're doing as far as using more e-filing, electronic filing, that we hope will mitigate the necessity to have any impact on the taxpayer, on kind of input we give the taxpayers as far as taxpayer assistance. We don't want to see that decline in any way. Our VITA sites, our commitment to the VITA sites, which help certain populations file their returns, for the most part seniors, populations that English isn't their first language. We will continue our commitment to those. So we're going to do everything possible, Chairman and members of the committee, not to have an impact felt by the taxpayer. And we think we've looked at this pretty thoroughly within the senior management team, and we think we can make the changes and make the reductions without any large impact on the taxpayer.
Any questions on this particular part? Well, there's still a few other pieces, but Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, last year we heard, is there feedback? We heard a lot of concern about, it was hard to retain staff because you were basically a training grounds for private industry. And so I'm just wondering, in lieu of cutting tuition benefits and all that kind of stuff, are you going to be able to retain high-quality staff you told me, I think, the story about somebody who lasted 4 hours and got a $20,000 raise somewhere else. So how do you address that in a time when you're cutting some of the other benefits?
Right. Sure. Chairman, Senator Olsen, we're going to be very cognizant of how we make these reductions. And we do probably have the most generous and robust tuition reimbursement program in state government. And right now, we reimburse up to $6,000 dollar for dollar for any training and tuition reimbursements that's related to your job. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find another agency that has that, but we found that to be a very important tool for our particular employees. And we're going to reduce that, we think, to about $5,000. So it's a relatively, in the scheme of things, but it's send a signal that we are tightening our belts. We hope it doesn't have too dramatic an impact and people still pursue that training. Retention is always a problem, and fortunately, we did extend our memorandum of understanding with the union with Dewar to allow additional pay increases for those audit positions. That's I think expires again in July 1st. So we'll be looking for another extension of that. It's been a very important tool, but I think that memorandum of understanding, the tuition reimbursement, and then thirdly, I just think the kind of culture that we've tried to create at the Department of Revenue is our three best rationales for people working there. Anyone who's familiar with the Department of Revenue, I mean, it does have a very professional environment. We try to, do as much to build team camaraderie and stuff. And people will stay there. They're not staying there for the pay. I'll tell tell you that right now. There's a lot of these people are very talented. They can go to private law firms, private CPA firms, and make a lot more money. But we try to really instill a culture at the Department of Revenue and a balance of life. And I think that is a big part of us doing our best to try to retain the workers. Sometimes salary considerations trump all those things, and we lose some very good people. But we will do everything we can, Senator Olsen, to make sure that we don't have a mass exodus from the Department of Revenue.
Senator Olsen?
A follow-up, if I may. Commissioner, one of the things was when you talked about senior staff leaving, it's my understanding that there's not a whole lot more senior staff that can leave. I mean, are you worried about losing the continuity of the department if you lose too much history of the department and those kinds of things?
Chairman, Senator Olsen, that's a very good point. One thing I think the Department of Revenue has done an exceptionally good job over the years on is our senior management team are true revenue professionals. I mean, you look at our senior management, even the assistant commissioners, there are people who have been in that agency for 25 years, very seasoned group, oftentimes worked in multiple divisions, so they have a true global understanding, macro understanding of the department. And we're losing some key people coming up. But you know what? We've done a pretty good job over time of training the next regime of leaders within the agency. We have a leadership academy where we try to identify the future leaders within the agency. Right now, I think we have started our neuroacademy with 60 individuals, kind of the next generation of leaders. But it is a challenge. It is a challenge. I would say the challenge for the most part when it comes to senior leadership is retirement. I think once folks have been there for 15, 20 years, they have become part of the Department of Revenue, and they're less likely to probably leave for private sector opportunities. And we're fortunate for that, I think, to a large extent, because we have a continuity of leadership. Everybody on the senior management team, except for me, has been with that department in some capacity for more than 10 years, 15 years. Nothing against political appointees like myself, but I think that's a good thing for that department. And it's always been a very professional senior management team. And we'll do everything we can to continue. But we got good people coming up through the ranks. We got good people at the director level, and we got good people at the division level and stuff. So I'm confident. There's a lot of quality, a lot of talent at the department.
Thank you. Other questions? Commissioner, you had two other matters you wanted to go over?
Yes. One is what I will term a compliance initiative, and it's modeled after what DHS currently has, which is a bank data match for child support payments. So we've had numerous conversations with the Department of Human Services about how this works, and we've modeled our proposal after that. And essentially what it is, does this, is this will allow us to be more efficient in collecting outstanding tax debts. And it, as I said, it works similar to what DHS has, where they identify, in their instance, people have outstanding child support obligations, and they send the information to the banks in a encrypted, secured form, and then the banks confirm, yes or no, this person does in fact have an account with us, and then if they do have the account, DHS or Department of Revenue Assistance would levy on that account the amount of the outstanding tax obligation. We put some additional safeguards into our proposal, we think. We are not going to use this tool. We would not use this tool for de minimis amounts, for small amounts. We would only use it when we had a lien in place. And the general rule of thumb for us with liens is $1,500 or more. So it had to be a fairly substantial tax obligation in order for this to be utilized. As you know, Chairman, a tax lien is public information. We file that with the county. And then we would send to the quarterly, we would send to the bank a list of all the people who had $1,500 or more, had a lien in place, a list of all those individuals. We'd send them the name, address, and only the last four digits of Social Security number. We'd send that in an encrypted form, secure, and then the financial institution would confirm whether there was an account in that person's name. And then if there was, in fact, we would have the prerogative to exercise the lien. And this is much more efficient than our current process. Our current process is much more time-consuming and labor-intensive. What we do is we issue a lien, we get a lien in place, and then we do some investigation, try to determine some asset information. Then we determine, well, taxpayer X may have an account with a certain institution, and we'll send a letter to that institution, basically providing the same information, address, name, and last four digits. then the institution will confirm to us whether there's a account in that taxpayer's name. So this is very similar to what we currently do. This is a much more productive way of doing it, and we think a much more efficient way of doing it than our current practice. And we expect this would generate about $10 million a year in enhanced tax collections. And we think that's a conservative estimate, but we've looked at some other states that have installed this program, and that's kind of in the range of what they generated.
I'm sure we'd have to get into the details on this, but the thing that comes to my mind, at first, if something goes wrong, there's got to be some sort of appellate process or somebody to challenge it or whatever. I mean, if you know these systems are not perfect, if Department of Human Services can issue a $1 million check to the wrong person, you know, we can probably pull some money out that we shouldn't have, and you know, we don't want somebody be waiting a couple of months to get this issue resolved. What are we going to do to make sure that we have a quick way of resolving disputes?
Yeah, Chairman, there are provisions in the language that would provide for a couple of safeguards. One is actually, I'm just going to have the language here real quick so I get it right. Provide a couple of safeguards. One is if a bank, this information, it's in the statute, it says exclusively, if this information has to be used exclusively for tax collection purposes, if a bank or financial institution used that information for any other purpose other than that, there would be a remedy in place that they would fall under a civil action for unauthorized disclosure by a financial institution. It also requires us to destroy this information shortly after it's no longer of any need to us. There is a civil. I think that's the primary safeguard in place. I know when this was vetted for DHS purposes, Chairman, there were a lot of concerns about this information being used in an inappropriate manner. As far as we know, and talking to our DHS counterparts, there hasn't been any problems, any use of the information in an appropriate way. We're doing something a little bit different than DHS. They use a third-party vendor for purposes of administering this program. We're going to do it in-house, which we think provides another layer of security, keeping it in-house, especially when you're talking about taxpayer information. We want to keep as much of that in-house as possible. But the main safeguard here is there is a civil action for unauthorized disclosure.
A few of us were here when the Department of Human Services came up with this brilliant idea of publishing the names of deadbeat dads who weren't paying child support, and that blew up on us big time when they published the wrong names, and we repealed that law rather quickly. So sometimes even Department of Human Services messes up. So, and as I say, there's some people who have some concerns about this, and after the commissioner is done with his testimony and overall, we'll hear from them. Do you have questions on the bank data? Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, my understanding with DPS is they have to have a court order to do that. Is that? I thought I read that just last week.
Commissioner Idas?
No, Chairman, Senator Olsen, no, they do not need a judgment or a lien of any kind. They actually have a more expedited process than what we're proposing here. Okay. We're going to only use this when a lien is in place.
Thank you.
Other questions on the bank data matches? Okay, Commissioner, you had another item that you
wanted to cover? Yeah, the other item I think which within this committee's purview is the establishment of a stamping office. And for surplus insurance lines, the whole concept of surplus insurance lines was totally foreign to me until we started vetting this proposal internally. And essentially what this surplus insurance lines, for those who don't know, are fairly obscure insurance policies that oftentimes you cannot secure in the domestic market. There are things like insurance for hot air balloon rides, amusement rides, NASCAR, maybe terrorist insurance, those kind of things. And oftentimes they cannot be secured by the domestic insurance market, the approved insurance market, I think is what it's referred. And so you have to go out of state, non-domestic insurance company to provide that. Currently, you don't have to be a license to sell surplus insurance lines into the state of Minnesota. So there's probably a certain level of non-compliance. The stamping office, which has been established in about 15 states now, would basically establish a non-profit entity that would serve as a stamping office. And every non surplus line insurance policy would have to go through the stamping office and receive an electronic stamp. And then that information would be shared with both the Department of Commerce and the Department of Revenue, so we'd have an idea, a fairly comprehensive idea, about how much surplus insurance has been sold into the state and who sold it. And so we could make sure that they're in compliance with the insurance premium tax. States that have imposed, or I shouldn't say imposed, established these stamping offices have seen revenue collections enhancements of between 25 to 200%. So this $3 million number that we're estimating is about a 25% increase in the insurance premium tax. Right now we collect about $12 million a year. So this would be a nonprofit, not a government entity. The Insurance Federation is supportive of this. There is a surplus line association. They're supportive of the creation of the stamping office. And so I think it's just a common sense kind of way to make sure we are collecting the premium tax that's due to the state of Minnesota. And it would put all insurance companies on an even playing field as well, the domestic and the non-domestic. I think another virtue of this proposal. We have to try to answer.
So it's going to cost $3 million in net. How much do you have?
Actually, the net enhancement of collections, insurance premium collections, about $3 million a year.
Okay.
This office will be funded exclusively by a stamping fee that's paid by the insurance companies. So there's no cost to the state in establishing the stamping office.
Is this kind of like the old insurance policies when people went to Lloyd's of London to insure some really odd things that... Frank Sinatra's singing voice, so that if you got laryngitis, they'd pay out or something. Is that okay?
Chairman, it's exactly that kind of insurance.
Okay.
It's exactly that kind of insurance.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Any questions on this item? Okay. Any questions of the department in general before I take those who have concerns about the bank data? Okay. And the commissioner is going to have to leave shortly because he's got a meeting over in the other body soon, so... Well, thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chairman.
And we do have, as I say, some people want to talk about the bank data matches, and I told we'd set aside a little bit of time for that. So welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Excuse me. My name is Steve Johnson, Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Bankers Association. Association represents approximately 450 members across the state, both large and small. Approximately 95% of the banks in Minnesota are members, and I appreciate that the chairman and the committee is allowing us to take a couple moments regarding the data match program. We really appreciate that the Department of Revenue gave us the opportunity to provide input to them on more than one occasion. We've had several discussions with them, and we also thank them for the changes that they've made to this point. Unfortunately, as it stands, the language still raises some concerns for our members. And banks are strong community members, and we certainly support tax compliance as a charge by the Revenue Department. And we want everyone to pay their fair taxes. But as the commissioner noted, this proposal is based on the Federal Child Support Data Match Program, in which departments assist the Department of Human Services in tracking down child support obligors. But there's some differences between the child support program and the proposed program. The child support program is a federally mandated program passed in Congress in 1996. Minnesota adopted it in 1997 and actually passed the compliance or the final rules or laws that allow it to be collected in 2002. So again, it's a federal program. So financial institutions from across the country are required to participate in the child support data match program, which prevents people from moving their accounts to other jurisdictions. The state-only program, such as this proposal, would allow bank customers to move their assets to out-of-state banks or even potentially internet financial institutions. It just seems to us, for example, if someone had an account in Minnesota, that they could easily, once they got wind of this program or this idea, they could move their account to Wisconsin or somewhere else. So that's one concern. We also note that financial institutions will need to incur additional costs in order to implement the data match program. We've chatted with a couple of our members about this program, and one of our smaller members estimated it would cost them about $2,311 to implement the program, and they're basing that off of what it cost them to implement the child support data match program back a few years ago. That doesn't count the costs of more server power, people and staff to look at the program and run the program and report any results. In addition, this bank said it would cost them roughly $465 a year annually to maintain the software. These costs will be incurred whether or not they have a match. The proposal before you includes $250,000 annually for reimbursement for financial institution costs. And the bill is specified as $150 per quarter for each financial institution if funds are available. Even if the $150 per quarter were available, it is nowhere near the actual cost of the financial institutions complying with this state-specific requirement. By our math, $150 per quarter, the amount allocated would only provide funds for 417 financial institutions be reimbursed per quarter, a fraction of the total financial institutions in the state. I mean, there's financial institution is defined very broadly in this bill, so it's a lot of different groups that are would be included as financial institutions. Another point I'd like to bring up is that in at least one other state that we've been aware of that has doing this program, the it's one department, their Department of Revenue, that has is collecting the data or working with the financial institutions. So in this instance, we're talking about the Department of Revenue and the Department of Human Services, so two departments, versus in another state where it's just one department that's kind of doing the scrub, if you will, or the data collection or working with the financial institutions. So here we're kind of sending it out twice. And then one last point I'd like to make just kind of generically is whenever data is moving back and forth, we were kind of hinting at it here a little bit earlier with some of the questions, there are privacy and liability questions that do occur, and I won't get into those very far. But those are our general kind of on the quick concerns with the legislation, and I'll just stop there and open myself to questions.
Have you heard of any other state that is running into problems? I mean, you mentioned the one where the a single agency. I mean, it's my understanding that other states are doing this. Have you heard from other banks of any other problems that have come up?
Mr. Chairman, I have not heard of any problems. I believe, as far as I know, there's only like a handful of states that are doing it, and someone in the room may have better knowledge of that than I, but I believe it's only four or five states that are doing it, and I think a lot of the same kind of questions come up in those states, and I'm not aware that I can, and I haven't had a chance to do thorough research, frankly, Mr. Chairman,
sure.
About that.
Okay.
So
it's a new suggestion.
Yes.
Here. Okay. Any other questions? General Singh, did you have a question?
Same as you.
Oh, same. Okay. Okay. Welcome to the Budget Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mara Humphrey. I'm the Vice President of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Credit Union Network, and we represent the state's 162 credit unions. And I'm up here to echo some concerns about the Department of Revenue's data matching proposal. I'm going to echo some of Steve's concerns that we have with the proposal. We have concerns about the additional burden that this is going to place on our financial institutions and on credit unions. Specifically, we have some concerns about the logistics of how the technical aspects of this bill would work. And I appreciate the Department of Revenue's willingness to work with us on the technical side, but I do have some concerns about the ability of some of our smaller credit unions to be able to comply with this. I also have some broader privacy concerns about this proposal. I think it creates a potential liability for credit unions and for financial institutions, and also some privacy concerns with credit unions sharing this account information. Another concern that we have is the cost to implement this and the cost for credit unions to comply with this proposal. I got feedback from a mid-sized credit union who estimates that it'll cost somewhere around $5,000 to get their software set up to be able to run this match through their data processor, and then a couple hundred every time they have to run a match. And one of the difficulties with this proposal is that this is just for Minnesota, not across the country like the child support proposal is. So they're going to have to run a specific software program, is my understanding, to be able to pull out these names. So those are just some of our concerns I wanted to share with the committee. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Just for my own information, it's my understanding this language is in a bill 3665 that Senator Ortman has introduced. Where was that bill sent? Was that to the tax committee? Okay, apparently it was sent to the tax committee. So that's why we don't have the language before us right now. So okay. Any questions? Okay, is there anybody else who wants to be heard on this particular issue, the bank data matches? Thank you very much. We're not making any decisions today. We're just trying to get a feel for what the issues are there. So I take it there's nothing further from the Department of Revenue then? Nothing? Okay. Okay. If nothing further, then thank you, Commissioner. And we'll move on to the Department of Administration. Okay, Commissioner Badgerow, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dana Badgerow. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Administration.
Stuff that you couldn't talk about last week is now fair game, I guess. So what does a budget cuts mean to administration?
I am free to talk about them, yes, Mr. Chair. Let me just first put this in context. The general fund is actually only 7.9% of our total budget. So we're really only looking at $11.8 million in general funds from which we can make the cuts to begin with. And then secondly, we have to look at the rest of our budget and protect certain things, those things that are statutorily mandated. And then we're a little bit unique in that if we don't do some services, typically then the agencies will do them themselves and probably less efficiently. So we have to be mindful of any cut that we make that will actually hurt our customer agencies. So we have to be careful not to pass off costs or simply shift costs to the operating agencies for whom we provide these services. So taking all of those things into account, after you sort of fence off a portion of our money, for example, which is our work comp reinsurance dollars, which are obviously not available, things like central mail and recycling, procurement, all of the implementation of 16C, not to mention our data practices office, the state archaeologist, and other things that are statutorily mandated, we don't have a lot left from which to cut. So kind of unlike the last speaker, Mr. Chair and members, these cuts are all relatively painful. So when we look at our 4% target, we are looking at cuts of $469,000, and I understand you have the handout.
Yes, we do.
That talks about how we intend to implement these cuts. And I might say that unlike the last speaker as well, we will be looking at reductions in our workforce in order to facilitate these cuts, the first of which would be in our energy management services group. We have a staff of 4 in that area, and we would propose to cut $175,000 from that group, leaving one person who would continue to administer the guaranteed savings contracts, which are, again, a statutory requirement. The activities of the Department of Administration are really basically in support of the Department of Commerce, which has taken a lead role in energy conservation. And I just want to reassure that we would continue strongly to support what the Department of Commerce is doing in energy. We still would be facilitating energy management in all state buildings through our Real Estate and Construction Management Services Group. And so this would be a reduction in the kinds of services that we provide for other state agencies as a nice to have. But quite frankly, the work that this group has done does require some additional infusion of monies. The governor had requested $500,000 in the last biennial budget to give this group some seed money with which to make some of the improvements in state buildings that might help with this energy conservation, and that request didn't make it through the legislative process. So basically, this staff is operating without investment monies, so we felt it was one of the places where we could afford to take this cut. The second one is a small cut in our resource recovery area. That's our recycling area around the Capitol complex. This is a small reduction in supplies. It simply means that we won't replace the recycling barrels and bins quite as frequently as we do today. Demographic services, we also have a small cut of $19,000. The focus of that office from now until 2010 in the census will be very much dedicated to making sure that that census is accurate. We've testified to that, I think, here in the last session. You gave us some additional monies for that. That enables us to free up a little bit of time and supplies to concentrate work on Census 2010. The next one is one we've talked about a number of times before this committee, the Land Management Information Center, which is partly generally funded. This cut would restore them to their base, Mr. Chair and members. Would restore them to the base that they had in place in 2007, which is $805,000. So it's an area in which we think, out of equity and fairness, we would ask that that particular division, it's again, does wonderful work, but we feel that all of the rest of our divisions within the Department of Administration are operating at or below their 2007 bases, that this would be a fair place to make that reduction. This would not require the layoff of people. This would mean scaling back some external consulting contracts. In the case of the Environmental Quality Board, we would simply hold one senior staff position, which has currently been vacated by a retirement. We would hold that position vacant. The Administrative Management Services then makes up the rest. It's $25,000, and it's basically a small reduction in the Management Analysis General Fund account and other very small changes, which we will hold by simply managing discretionary expenses. Those are the reductions, Mr. Chair and members, and I have another large reduction over on the next page, which I guess I could skip to, which is simply returning to the general fund the $885,000 that had been appropriated in this biennium for the relocation of the Department of Public Safety out of downtown St. Paul. Originally, we had hoped to move them out to another facility outside of the downtown area so that they could co-locate with their emergency management operations. As it turned out, none of the proposals we received was affordable. And in fact, the landlord in downtown St. Paul has been very fair and wonderful to work with, and we are renegotiating our lease with that landlord, and the Department of Public Safety will remain in downtown St. Paul for the next 5 years. So in light of the renegotiation of that lease, we will not need that relocation money, and it can be returned to the general fund.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, that DPS relocation, was that the stuff that had to do with the Homeland Security compliance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, in part, but the Homeland Security Office is a relatively small part, square footage-wise, of the entire public safety headquarters, which are all located in the same building in downtown St. Paul. We do still have aspirations eventually to move that Homeland Security Office to a place that is more compliant with the federal rules. That, in fact, is part of the governor's bonding proposal to ask for money for a pre-design on what would be a good location for that particular piece. But this was for the whole department, commissioner's staff, and all divisions, and they will not be moving.
A follow-up.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, is it LIMIC, the land management information?
Mm-hmm.
Is that on any kind of a fee basis? Is there room to raise fees in that?
For sure.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, this had been a part of the governor's budget reduction package now for the last several biennia, last several budget reduction cycles. And it is true that this is an office that has an awful lot of advocates out in the field, in the counties and in the cities, who use the services of this office. So every time we propose them as a cut, they come and testify before these committees as to what a wonderful set of services that the office offers. There is a piece of LIMIC that does, in fact, operate on a for-fee or consulting basis, and it's one of our enterprise funds. And quite frankly, that amount of business has been going down as agencies' ability to pay has gone down, and there's been more and more reliance upon the general fund activities. We do have the option, however, to charge agencies and local units for these services if they are willing and have the ability to pay. And we also have some grants coming into that enterprise fund as well.
Sir, we'll see.
Just a quick follow-up, because I know you're right. We got a ton of emails from, you know, land surveyors and stuff. So if they're such an advocate for the office, shouldn't there be some opportunity to bill the services to those kinds of companies?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to sort of sound like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, but a lot of what they do is appropriate for general fund. They establish standards for GIS data collection. They do collect data that is not specific to a particular area or unit. It is statewide data. I think they have a general fund purpose in life, and so it's segregating out when they do some very site-specific or very data-specific work for an agency like DNR, for example, who is, in fact, willing to pay and does pay. versus the overall enterprise work that they do on behalf of all of state and local governments, setting up our enterprise GIS system, which does have to all work together and overlay, and is extremely important that we have that system in place.
Sir Pappas?
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, there's a Department of Motor Vehicles office, public office, right, downtown St. Paul. Is the Department of Public Safety then in that same building?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, they are.
And that's on, I can visualize it, but what street is it
on? Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, my phone a friend told me it's in Town Square.
The old Town Square.
Okay. Ms. Madigan, did you have anything further to add?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention that we do, however, have a positive request, a request for additional funds of $185,000 that I do want to mention and speak in behalf of. This is part of the governor's package of a number of proposals that are helpful to our veterans. This would establish a preference in state contracts for veteran-owned businesses, much like we currently have for minority and women and disabled-owned businesses. It would grant up to a 6% preference for businesses that can certify their ownership are veterans having served in the United States Armed Forces. There's a little more money required to start this up because we would need to establish the programs and certify. We estimate there may be as many as 6,000 businesses that may qualify for this preference. We don't expect to certify them all, but we do go through a certification and validation process to make absolutely certain that the ownership is, in fact, veteran-owned, that it is legitimate ownership. And then we would administer the preference with two people to start with and one person on an ongoing basis to keep those certifications valid. So that's a request for $185,000 in fiscal year 2009. And again, as I mentioned, it is part of the governor's overall veterans package.
The legislature, I think, at least the Senate, I think, passed Senator Wergen's bill last year. No, we didn't fund it, but I don't know if the bill actually was enacted into law. I don't know. Mr. Bodnar, it was not. Does anybody recall?
Mr. Chair, it was not, and it did have this precise fiscal note attached to it.
Okay.
And it may have been the reason it didn't pass.
Yeah, I remember it passed the Senate floor, but apparently then it got held up because the appropriation was not there. So, okay. Okay. Any questions for the Department Administration? Anything else? Well, thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We next have the Office of Enterprise Technology. Mr. Khanna. Welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Gopal Khanna. I'm the state CIO with Office of Enterprise Technology. I also have here with me two of my associates, John Lally, Director of Planning, and Larry Freund, CFO of OET. We are here to quickly talk to you about two items that we need to take into consideration as we look at budget shortfalls. And maybe what I'll do is pass on to my colleague over here to walk us through those two items. John Lally, if you do that, please.
Mr. Lally.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is John Lally. As Kapal said, I'm director for OET. We have a relatively small piece of general fund out of our total budget. Most of it is, if you'll recall from our overview a few weeks ago, fees that are charged for specific services to agencies. And this portion is tied up in two activities, and I think you have a handout in front of
yes.
you. Enterprise planning and management is all the really important stuff in the department. That has my salary, Gopal's salary. So this is the part is that the headquarters for the department, but it is also the portion of the department's activities that does planning, does project management and oversight functions, does the financial analysis of budget proposals, does all the policy and public information aspects of OET's operation. The principal effect of the cut in our base budget is not to require us to lay anybody off. It will prevent the hiring of people we had planned on hiring. In this fiscal year, we were trying to bring a reengineering architect on board, business process redesign person. in next fiscal year, we wanted to bring somebody to more aggressively allow us to do audits on projects. Those will not be able to be filled under this provision. Equal concern to us is our highest priority is enterprise IT security. As you'll recall, there's a significant general fund component to the IT security activity. We will be trying to protect our highest priorities in the security area with this cut. But I have to tell you, of great concern to us is what will happen next fiscal year when we're going to be taking an additional $1.5 million cut that was in the budget last year. And that will also have a significant impact on our operations. So those are the two general fund areas for the department. Paul, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Our chief financial officer here is also able to answer specifics.
I've got a couple of questions. I'm reading on the security that will work to minimize staff reductions through attrition or layoffs if necessary. I think the type of people who work in this area are not going to leave through retirement anytime soon. They tend to be a younger crowd, I think. So it probably would. They either get a better job that pays more, or you let them go. But I'm worried about this area because this is a, computer security. We're getting vulnerable every day with new threats that come to us, and if we scale back at that, with all the increased use of technology, all we need is one very bad thing to happen, and somebody hacks into Department of Revenue or Department of some database, and things going out on the internet, or personal data is compromised. I'm a bit concerned about that. How are we going to be able to tell the public that we're going to maintain our security? It says we don't know the exact impact of the proposed reduction. The high priority areas of vulnerability and threat management, security monitoring will be protected from its efforts. How do we know that?
Mr. Chairman, we don't have adequate funding for security right now. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to kid you that protecting this cut is going to give us that. It'll make the problem more difficult for us, both in terms of staffing and in terms of the tools of information security that we need to try to maintain integrity in our systems and our networks and so on. We will try. The reason we don't have the specifics yet is because we have to figure out how we can leverage the staff we do have, how we can balance off those tasks as much as possible. But I'm not going to say to you that we're going to be able to maintain the integrity of the systems. We don't have that integrity now. We're still trying to get to that point.
Then there's a different issue that we dealt with last year. It's not on your list, but I just had a meeting this morning on this regarding e-licensing, where people can go online to renew their licensing. We did appropriate some money last year for this, and I think that this is something the public is interested in and would like down the road, but I think that if we scale back on security, it's going to create some problems down the road if people are going to be providing personal information on to get their licenses online, and then the security may be compromised, and so that's another issue that is coming up that makes it even more of a critical area I'm concerned about. So, and the contract was just signed last week to proceed with the next stage of e-licensing. So Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Kelly. I guess you talk about the difficulty of covering the bases with the cuts that you currently have. I guess I've wondered, as each of the commissioners has made a comment here, the governor is projecting a deficit in the next biennium of about $700 million, which, of course, is without inflation. And if we include inflation, it's probably close to $2 billion. What kind of impacts, I guess, I think, what you do is important to... how far can we go on these cuts without really kind of gutting the work that is done by your office?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, the work that we have embarked upon is a long journey, because we do have in place systems that were developed over the last 20, 30 years and that have stayed in production and will continue to support the agency's needs and states' major mission-critical applications and systems. However, sir, going forward, it will take 10 years, at least minimally, to transform all of these aged applications and bring them into the 21st century. So it's not an overnight journey. Yes, indeed, we'll need more resources, and going forth, we'll have to pay greater attention to and invest in our government operations infrastructure.
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Ghana. You know, I guess, you know, as I listen to your testimony and hear that a 4% cut, I mean, we're looking at one for the next biennium that will probably be an 8% cut. I just wonder, you know, how long we're going to be able to continue services without properly funding them. I mean, you know, at what point does even the work that you're able to carry on continue with the same kind of value that it's had historically, I guess, you know, so I don't know. I have some concerns about that.
Other questions for the Office of Enterprise Technology? Let me also just share another conversation we had this morning. I mentioned e-licensing a moment ago, and you know, could you just kind of bring the division just up to speed as to where you are on that and what we think is going to happen? Because we may have to look at the impact of that in the total area of the budget issues that we're facing. What's going on with the e-licensing?
Mr. Chairman, basically where we are at is the $7.5 million that was given to us last year, we have been able to put in place a team, and we have already spent, and CFO here can help us walk through the numbers, but we have spent some monies, we have targeted some expenses that are coming forth, and we have signed an agreement worth about $4.5 million in the vicinity of that, and we are prepared with our plan to go forward with the program. However, I fully understand the challenges ahead before us, and we do need to take a look at what might be options and alternatives going forward, and we'll be coming back with that to you, sir.
And apparently the state already started on the road down there before and backed out, and now we've had the appropriation last year. The contracts were signed last week. I think it was just a coincidence that it just came at this particular time period, but we have to figure out how this fits in the whole scheme of things, too. So, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And whoever can answer the question, I was kind of thinking about it in terms of the e-licensing, and as we move forward on that, does that actually put us at more security risks as well, I would kind of assume, and maybe these budget cuts to the security could be extremely harmful?
Yeah, my concern, yeah. Mr. Connor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jungbauer, as we design new systems, we're going to incorporate all the disciplines and requirements of security upstream rather than downstream. When our systems were developed 20, 30 years ago, we did not have the security challenges that we face as a nation today. So hence the need to shore up our security posture. For new applications and new systems design going forward, the Portfolio Management Group has identified that all the needs are taken care of upstream rather than downstream in the design itself. So we are hoping and expect our new systems as they're rolled out to take care of those security needs in the design of the application itself.
Mr. Lally.
Chairman, Senator Jungbauer, the answer to your question is yes, you should be concerned about bringing on any new application. Donna has said we are trying in the planning process to make sure that applications include that, but there's more to it than that. The infrastructure for security has to be there to support the application security, and that's where our concern is at OET, because we're responsible for that. Parallel component to the application, the licensing piece will have its own application security, but it exists in an environment that must also be secure.
Senator,
I guess, Mr. Chair and members, as we move forward on some of this, I hope we keep that kind of in the forefront, because as our chairman said, kind of made mention, that all it would take is one breach of security and we'd be spending a whole lot more money than these budget reductions, and that's troubling to consider it that way.
Yes, it is. Anything else for the Office of Enterprise Technology? Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, thank you.
Okay. Next, we have the Department of Finance, which also includes the Department of Employee Relations for the time being. Ms. Andrews, welcome back to the Budget Division.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Said, I'm going to be discussing the reductions for both Finance and the Department of Employee Relations. As you remember, as of June 1st, we will be a merged agency, so that as we're talking about fiscal 2009, that includes both of our agencies. And I'm only going to be discussing the operating budget reduction. There are three recommendations in the governor's budget for the non-operating funds in finance, which include the workers' compensation and the budget reserve and another one. But you heard about those from the budget officers last week, so I'm assuming that you don't probably need more information on those, though we certainly can talk about those if you'd like. The 4% reduction recommended by the governor is $842,000 a year for finance and for employee relations. Over 80% of the funds in our budget are related to personnel, to salaries and benefits, and so most of the reductions that we've been considering obviously have to do with those costs. We anticipate that the 4% reduction will be a reduction of approximately 10 positions at this point in time. We're certainly hoping that we can achieve those reductions through retirement and attrition. We have some uncertainties as we look forward about which specific positions that will include. Are you hearing the same feedback that I'm hearing?
Yeah, we might be one of those mics down there, but we're getting some, yeah.
Is it better if I try this one?
Go ahead.
Let's try this one.
Can't get worse.
So as I was saying, we're certainly hoping that we can achieve these reductions through attrition and retirement. As we look at which parts of the budget to reduce, we have a fair amount of restrictions on what we're able to do because many of the personnel and systems, our dollars are spent on managing our statewide systems. You know, obviously, you've heard a lot about the MAPS and the Semaphore systems, the statewide payroll and accounting systems that we run. And the positions, while we're continually looking at ways to manage those systems more efficiently, there is a limit as to how much we can reduce the staff that run those systems. And so as we look at reductions for this budget, we're really looking then at the part of actually the agency that you see the most, some of the value-added, as we talk about them, parts of the agency that provide oversight, that provide analysis to the legislature and to the public and to other agencies. We'll certainly continue to do that as well as we can, but we are looking at reductions in those areas. You've heard again from the OLA about their recommendations for our work in financial reporting and our managing of the information access warehouse. Again, we'd be looking at ways to manage those a little bit differently, but we'll continue to have some challenges ahead in terms of providing the documentation and oversight that they're looking for. That said, we still believe that these reductions, in terms of the context of the budget deficit that's in front of us, that we will manage them as best we can. We also have some limits on our flexibility due to the worker protection language that was included in the merger legislation passed last year. As you remember, that language prohibits us from making a change to people's employment situation because of the merger. And so we'll be looking, obviously, at what we can do related to the budget reduction, but end up being in a little bit of a funny place because some of the places where we might have some redundancy would be more likely to be considered merger-related reductions, and we're not able to do that because of the law. So again, we would be looking to some of these other more analysis and oversight positions for reductions.
I have one or two questions. The question of the budget reserves, it's properly for the full finance committee, but since Finance Department is under this jurisdiction, I'm pretty sure we're going to wind up taking part of the reserves. The governor's proposing it. I'm sure the legislature is going to take it. We can't obviously spend it all down because then we've got no options if we have another bad forecast next November or next February. But how is it our state's bond rating looking now, and what may happen to it if we start drawing down those reserves? I remember last, in the early 90s when we had a problem there, it took us about 12 years to restore our full bond rating, and I don't know where it is right now.
Thank you for asking that, Mr. Chair. Obviously, a really important question as we tried to put together the governor's budget and look at the balance of that issue. The budget reserve is one of the most important things the rating agencies look at as they try to evaluate the financial management practices of our state. We don't believe that that single action would lead to a downgrade. It is part of the context that they look at. As they've told us before, when we went through and used the budget reserve before for budget reductions, the fact that we had a plan in place to restore it was very critical to them. That being said, they also look at how or why the budget reserve is being used. Is it being used as a stopgap to get you to some more permanent reductions, or just used because decision makers didn't want to make some changes in priorities and make some real reductions? And so they don't look kindly on the budget reserves being used simply to avoid hard choices. The key thing, as you mentioned, was being very careful about how much of the budget reserve is used, given the fact that we also have a fair amount of time in the biennium left. And so because we have two forecasts still remaining before we close out this biennium, if the budget reserve were to drop far beyond where the governor recommended, much beyond where the governor recommended, we would have some real concerns about being able to weather any further downturns without some really serious consequences.
And again, as to the 10 positions that you anticipate might be lost through the reductions that are being proposed by the governor, Do you foresee any cutbacks in service to the public, any extended time periods before the public can be served, or what will actually be the impact that is seen? I mean, you can't just eliminate 10 positions and have nothing happen, or we would have done that before. So
that's right, Mr. Chair. Certainly, I think that, as you know, many of the services that we provide are to the public, are to the legislature also, and are to other agencies, and so many of the services are more back room. We will, again, try to maintain a high level of service, but we do anticipate that it might mean that we will have more people. Just a simple example, you know that we have budget officers that work with your committees, and they're allocated. Basically, each budget officer has a couple different agencies and areas that they work with. If we were to reduce one of those positions, it doesn't mean we would stop serving anybody. It might mean that we were able to do less in-depth analysis or less in-depth assistance to agencies or to the public or to the legislature if they needed that. Again, we'll try our very best to make sure that that doesn't happen. We also are looking at some reductions in things like communications and graphics production and those things. Again, reports and things that you're used to seeing in a certain way might either be a little less flashy, which I think you probably would be okay with, but they also may have more trouble, again, going to the level of analysis that we've been trying to do in the past.
Thank you. Any questions for the Finance Department? Senator Olstein.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Andrews, what is your total staff number?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olstein, currently we are at 100 and I'm hesitating because we're currently merging in people each week from the Department of Employee Relations. Let me answer it this way. When we're completely merged, we will have about 260 FTE. So in fiscal 2009, the budget that you're looking at will be at about 260.
And how many of those are Dewar positions? You mentioned the problem with the language from last year, but how many does Dewar have?
Mr. Chair, we're getting about 110, between 100 and 110 FTEs from Dewar.
Okay.
So and it almost doubles our size.
And not all of Dewar's employees are going to go to you because they're going to go to three different agencies.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. About 30 have already gone to the Department of Administration, and one person went to the Department of Health. The remaining people right now in Dewar will be coming to Finance.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Olstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The follow-up, I guess I would ask then, is because if I remember right, you guys were pretty much had the same kind of problem that the Department of Revenue had retaining, high-valued employees. So what's your plan to maintain quality staff while you're still cutting? And
Mr. Chair, Senator Olstein,
Commissioner,
I think it's a challenge across state government, both because our staff are good, they're also highly visible, and they also have some other opportunities in local governments, for example, where they make more money than state government. That's not true only for finance. That's true across state government. We also, we will continue in finance to try to do the kind of work that we've been doing. We hope to be able to do more of it going forward in terms of professional development, but frankly, as you heard the Department of Revenue talk about their resources and their tuition reimbursement programs, we've never been able to approach that kind of professional development resources in finance And so the best we can often do is to try to ensure that people feel the sense of professionalism and camaraderie and feel that that's fulfilling enough to get them. I think that for many of the people that work in our agency, they see it as a real statewide honor, frankly, an honor to be able to have a statewide role and to provide oversight and analysis and assistance to agencies and the public and the legislature in such a broad area. And so I think that's often very compelling and exciting for people to work with. As I think Commissioner Ines said, and I'd echo that, most of the people working here at Finance aren't working because it's a financial boon to them, but that the work is satisfying, and we'll have to keep pushing that as much as we can.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions of Finance or Doer? Thank you very much. And then the last item we have on the agenda is Amateur Sports Commission. And I think the one thing that we are looking at here is the fact that, and I guess Senator Pappas, Senator Rest, and I were in the legislature in 1994 when the Target Center purchase was done, and part of that bill required that a certain number of hours had to be set aside for amateur sports, and I think the appropriation was for $750,000, which I think is a pass-through through amateur sports. So we want to have both the Amateur Sports Commission and the City of Minneapolis here to talk about the impact of that. So, Mr. Erickson, did you want to come forward? If somebody's free from Minneapolis, you can also tell us. And if I've got it quite wrong, please correct me, but welcome back to the Budget Division, Mr. Erickson.
Mr. Chairman, the governing document between the Amateur Sports Commission and, at that time, Ogden Entertainment Services and Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission is dated March 1st, and I think in talking to staff, the key things that are of concern to you, it said that the term of the agreement shall commence on March 23rd, 1995, and shall continue until the retirement of revenue bonds. And then in another section, it indicates that the anticipated time, it says, if not prior terminated under Section 6.2 upon retirement of revenue bonds, currently scheduled for 2009. So while the legislature has often attempted to eliminate the appropriation, it does, according to our agreement, it is scheduled for our last payment. We've been making $750,000 payments, pass-through payments, as we would term them, July 1st of every year since 1995. So apparently there's one payment remaining, and but for whatever reason, the governor has, I think, decided to end
it. Mr. Erickson, then, is that actually coming out of the budget of the Amateur Sports Commission, or does it pass through you, or just where does the money come from? From the state through you to them?
Right, yeah. Mr. Chairman, each year when you appropriate our operating budget, right now it's $300,000, there will be a line item for that, and then the legislature also appropriates $750,000 for the purposes of the Target Center agreement. So we never touch or feel or get the benefit of it. We simply pass it through to the Target Center.
And I think, as I recall, the purpose of this was so that there would be amateur sports events at the Target Center. How has that worked out?
Mr. Chairman, looking back, I think at that time, the administration's intent was to support the Target Center, and then it was a secondary exercise to identify potential benefits. And we were asked, could you find some benefits? And at the time, in 1995, we said, well, there might be some dates on occasion. And all of a sudden, before we knew it, they were giving us 50 dates before we had asked for one. And in the first two or three years of the agreement, we did make an attempt. At that time, it was Ogden. I think there's been four operators since Ogden. And we worked, and we had a World Figure Skating Championship and a National Figure Skating, and we used to run a youth basketball event where the championship games were at Target Center. But we were supposed to get them rent-free, but the fees that we were charged were so significantly high that it became impractical. So after the first few years, we deemed it totally without value to attempt to do dates there. And so I think we might have done dates in 95, 96, 97, but none since that time. In several legislative audit reports, when we were asked why we aren't accomplishing the state value, we simply said that the agency has determined that there is no value to use that facility at the rates that they were charging us. And that's been our position for, I think, at least 12 years.
Okay, and we have the City of Minneapolis here, too. Mr. Bourne?
Yes.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Pat Bourne. I'm the city's chief financial officer.
Go ahead.
Thank you. And members, thank you for hearing us out today, too. Mr. Erickson and I don't know each other, and I can only say that the lease between the commission and the and our operator continues to this day. It does provide for a reimbursement of expenses, which I'm sure, as Mr. Erickson is saying, may be more than what an event may be able to bear. But it, that, nevertheless, is a subsidized arrangement should the commission ever choose to have events at Target Center. I would, though, go what I think back is to the basic equity of the arrangement between the city and the state in this respect. And unlike, I think, most of the other kinds of things that the governor has recommended expense reductions on, this is not really an expense reduction because the city has uses this $750,000 a year for the purpose of paying debt service. So this, in effect, would cause a shift of obligation from the state of $750,000 a year to the city at a time when other revenues, even for the Target Center that we use for Target Center, are already being challenged from a number of other sources and circumstances. So this really isn't an expense reduction in the main. It is really a shift from the state to the city of where this expense would be paid. I'd hasten to add that all of the taxes that the city receives from Target Center property and entertainment, with the exception of our sales tax, which can only be used for the convention center purposes, are used to support Target Center. Plus, in addition to that, we use other revenue sources that aren't really related to Target Center to support the balance of sources that we use to pay the $6 million a year in debt service on bonds the city issued back in 1995 to acquire Target Center for the purpose of keeping the Timberwolves in Minnesota. So while the commission has not perhaps made use or been able to make use of the lease at Target Center, nevertheless, the city views this $750,000 a year as an essential funding source to match up with city revenues to support Target Center.
And I guess those of us who were here at the time, I remember, I mean, we passed the bill, and 2 weeks later, the owners of the Timberwolves announced that they were going to try to move the team to New Orleans, and ultimately it worked out that they stayed here. But one of the provisions of the bill that we did pass require that the National Basketball Association keep a team in here in the Target Center as a condition of the building being purchased. And I don't know if, you know, going back and changing some of these terms now would affect, you know, the deal that we made back in 1994 or not. I don't know if that anybody's got the answer here today, but I think we need to be cognizant that, you know, this was a part of a deal to keep the team here, and I don't know where it would sit anymore. Any other questions? Sir, we'll see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bourne, kind of along those lines, I guess I wouldn't mind subsidizing the Target Center to keep the Timberwolves here, but I think it would have been more appropriate to call it that because the Education Policy Committee just toured a high school league during the hockey tournament, and we sat in on one of their meetings. And it seems to me that, you know, like was mentioned earlier about the fees to have access to the facility, that this really is almost a direct subsidy, and if that's what it is, it should be called that. So I have some concern that it hasn't been used this way I mean, we just heard about the ticket scalping for the hockey games. I mean, if we want to have access for our high school league and amateur sports, here was an opportunity to do it, and it seems to me like it just wasn't that it never happened, and I'm worried about that. And it also, a second part, is there just one more payment left? Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, members.
Mr. Bourne.
Thank you. Based on the original understanding, yes. There is, I believe, I can't remember when exactly the payments were made, but they were to be made through 2009, is my understanding. And that's, that I believe is how the agreements were drafted. Several years ago, however, that $750 was converted into a standing appropriation for reasons I'm not familiar with, but I'm certainly grateful for. And I, Senator, I don't know that I disagree with how this ought to be characterized. I think if it ought to be characterized as a subsidy, I think there's ample reason for the state to do that. The city is using virtually all of its tax revenues and then some to support Target Center, but the state's tax yield from Target Center activities is multiple times the $750,000. And we think a very good rationale exists to support Target Center based on simply the tax yield the state enjoys from Target Center activities.
Mr. Bourne, then who actually owns the Target Center?
Mr. Chair, the City of Minneapolis owns Target Center.
Okay, and that was the purchase in 1994, and that was like, I think the bill was like for $42 million or something like that, is it?
Chair, the city acquired Target Center for about $82 million.
Okay. The state. I'm thinking the state's share, obviously, then okay, what we kicked in, I think, but it was still much lower than what the owners at the time wanted to sell it for. They wanted well over $100 million, and, you know, we brought the price down. So has it been, does the city own it now, or are we still having to make payments on it, and how long will it go?
Mr. Chair, the city does own Target Center outright. We issued bonds.
Right.
Back in 1995 to acquire Target Center. Those bonds will make payments through 2024,
yeah.
2025, which is the final year of the lease between the city and the Timberwolves.
Okay.
At one point, Mr. Chair, you raised an interesting point earlier. At one point early on, the Timberwolves did have an ability to terminate their lease. Those termination provisions and conditions have now expired. And so we believe that the Timberwolves do have a legal commitment to play in this arena until 2025. The NBA, on the other hand, does not make a commitment to keep a team here. The agreement is solely with the team and any successor and ownership.
Okay, I could be mistaken. I just thought that the bill that we passed, one of the conditions was the NBA had to guarantee a team here, just like with the Metrodome, the National Football League had to guarantee that a team was going to be in that facility, which is why the Vikings cannot break their lease. But, you know, I could be mistaken. I'm just trying to remember something from 1994.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm not familiar with all of the state laws that might pertain to this. I can just speak to the agreement between the city and the Timberwolves.
Okay. Are there any other questions about this this particular part of the budget proposal? There's what, $750,000 is what the governor's proposing to terminate that payment. Okay. Okay. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on any aspect of what we also discussed today? Then Wednesday, Senator Pappas?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, where's the legislative auditor's budget? Is that part of
here.
Our division?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
If they were asked to cut, it would be part of the legislature?
Well, we're going to be meeting on Wednesday when we're going to be having the constitutional officers. We had the governor's office in last week, so I didn't see a need to bring them back again. But the other ones that will be affected. The governor proposed a 4% reduction, and we'd like to hear from them
Who else do we have next week? The
AG.
Well, the AG, the state auditor, the attorney general. Well, the attorney general, the state auditor, secretary of state, right here.
And the legislature.
And the legislature. So the legislature's budget, both the Senate, the House, and the things like the revisor's office, the legislative auditor, and so forth, are within the, and the governor's proposing a significant cut in the legislative budget. So I don't know that we'll have anybody from the House of Representatives coming on over telling us how it's going to affect them, but we should at least have some idea what where the what impacts it might mean on the Senate's budget. We'll have that available by Wednesday. We've also got four bills to hear, too.
Mr. Chairman, with our Secretary of the Senate, Pat Flavin, he's been ill.
Mm-hmm.
Who's kind of in charge of the Senate now?
Well, I don't know. We do have the first assistant, Mike Lynn, of course, has been doing most of the work, but
on the floor. But in terms of management,
I don't know that.
Jim Green.
Okay, apparently Mr. Greenwald has assumed some responsibilities here. But it raises an interesting question. I mean, at some point, Mr. Flavin will be retiring. I mean, he's getting up there in years, too. And when he became the Secretary of the Senate, he was only the second full-time secretary we ever had because we didn't need him. I mean, they only met every other year, and so why did you need a full-time secretary? And the Senate had like 50 employees back then. Now we've got well over 300, and, of course, during the sessions, we hire a lot of additional staff, too. We have many more responsibilities, functions, whether it's the budget or technology that we never had before. So that job has changed quite a bit. We still need a parliamentarian, obviously, but we need a chief fiscal officer. We need a chief executive officer. It's just a lot of work that to expect for one person to do anymore. So we have to figure out what the needs of the Senate are down the road, too. So, but we'll hear something about the Senate's budget, I think, on Wednesday here. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, with that, meeting adjourned. See you Wednesday.